Welcome to the Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by the Funny Womax and Friends. If you're looking to get more out of your Shenandoah Valley experience, then this is the podcast for you. You'll meet interesting people, musicians, and comedians that perform here and find out more about what you can do and see. Whether you live here or plan to visit, listen to explore what makes our unique slice of heaven. Now here's your host, Don Davis Womack.
Hello, laughers. I'm delighted to welcome Dale McAllister, the local go-to historian for the Harrisonburg, Rockingham County. He is a native of Singers Glen, a retired educator with over three decades of teaching eighth grade science, and has also spent much of his life uncovering the rich history of the Shenandoah Valley. As the former president of the Harrisonburg, Rockingham Historical Society, also known as Rocktown History, he is the leader of the Shenandoah Valley Folklife Society as well, and has written extensively on local history, including the acclaimed book, Lucy Frances Sims, From Slavery to Revered Public Service. Today, he's here to take us on a journey through some of the Valley's nostalgic holiday history and traditions. Welcome to the podcast, Dale. It is a joy to be with you today.
Thank you very much.
This is so exciting. You have so many years' experience in the rich history of our culture and heritage around here. I'm super excited to get into this with you. I'd like to talk about first, how did you discover your passion for history? What inspired you to go down this road to begin with?
I had a great uncle who was, he worked in the Cleveland area of Ohio for all of his working career. But when he retired, he came back here to the Valley, and he was vastly interested in family history and genealogy, and did a lot of searching through cemeteries for relatives that he wanted to get data on. And he used to talk to me about what he was finding and what he planned to do, and it kind of got me interested in the local history at that time.
Yeah, and you were in your 20s at that time. Were you attending, I didn't share this part, I believe, but you were was a physics major at Bridgewater College, and that's what you graduated with, right?
Correct,
So was it during that time that you had these discussions with your uncle, or was this post-college?
It was mostly post-college.
Okay. And how did you become the go-to historian then around here?
Well, I've been a member of the Harrisonburg Rockingham Historical Society, now known as Rocktown History, since the 1970s, and so that's a lot of years in between. Yes. For working with Valley history and local history, and have been interested in doing a good bit of writing about different topics over the years, and so doing research for those, you become more knowledgeable about local history and topics that are important.
Mm-hmm. Like the book that you just wrote recently, that was published in 2020, right?
Right.
Okay.
So that was about Lucy Frances Sims, a person I've always been intrigued about because she was born as a slave, an enslaved person in the family of Robert Gray in Harrisonburg, and she grew up on that farm where her masters had her family, her mother and her grandmother, in their employment, well, not in employment, but in enslavement. And she was able, the Gray family, after emancipation, helped her secure an education from Hampton Institute, now Hampton University. And she went there for 3 years. Hampton couldn't confer a bachelor's degree until the 1920s, so she didn't get that. But her 3 years earned her a certificate that was the highest certificate for teaching in the public schools. So she was able to start teaching. She spent 1 year in a Rockingham County school, and then all the rest of her long 46-year career in education was spent in Harrisonburg. And she was a beloved teacher. Her community cared so much for her that she became a legend. And there aren't too many teachers that end up teaching more than 46 years, which she did. The summer she died, she was found on her front porch, slumped over her railing, planning to teach that next year, which would have been her 47th year teaching.
Wow.
So she's been honored not only locally, but also statewide.
Mm-hmm.
She's been nominated for different reasons. There's an island in the James River at Richmond that has a monument that she's included as one of the important African Americans in the whole state.
Wow, I didn't know that. Wow. And the Lucy Sims Center, that's...
Yeah, when the next... She was teaching in a schoolhouse that was called the Effinger Street School. It was a nice brick school building, but Harrisonburg needed a larger building. When they built that one a few years after her death, they named it for her, Lucy F. Sims School.
Okay, that's been... I don't know how long that school's been. It's not a school any longer, but I don't know how long that building has been here. Do you?
1939.
Okay, 1939.
Is when it was built. And it was a school until desegregation in the 1960s.
Okay.
And so at that point, it became more like a community center for that part of Harrisonburg.
Yeah. That's a whole nother episode right there. That part of Harrisonburg, we'll probably have to come back on for that. So
for many years known as Newtown,
yes,
and now called the Northeast Neighborhood.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I wanted to ask you, when you dig into history, what is your process? What does that look like? What's your approach in discovering and digging for information?
Well, I just try to be accurate in what I write, and certainly don't want things that are being told untruthfully. And I think that's my main concern. There are lots and lots of written materials about Harrisonburg and Rockingham County that can serve as information for writing.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I enjoy is spending time looking online at the newspapers that have been digitized, the local paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you can find so much information that doesn't exist elsewhere.
Okay. And that's where you start, is those articles that you can find online then?
Well, yes.
Oftentimes.
Yes.
Okay.
Mention of things that are related to what you're trying to write about.
Okay. You've covered some pretty unique topics too. In preparing for this interview today, I discovered you have actually looked into the tracing of one of Elvis Presley's family lines right back here to the Rockingham County where we're sitting in right now. How close are the relatives that Elvis Presley's lineage comes from in relation to where we're sitting at the moment?
Well, we're sitting in the town of Dayton, and the oldest house here in Dayton is Fort Harrison, and that Harrison family is the line that Elvis Presley descends from. Also, Harrisonburg, which is just a few miles away, is named for Thomas Harrison, who was a brother of the Harrison that was here at Dayton. So Elvis Presley is actually a direct descendant of Thomas Harrison, who founded Harrisonburg in the mid-1700s.
That is crazy. How did you discover that?
I think I saw mention of some Presleys in some information about Elvis's line that led me back to think, well, maybe he was from the Harrisons here in the Shenandoah Valley. And it turned out to be true.
That is amazing. Yeah, this is an incredible part of the country for a lot of history, and it certainly has a rich heritage. And we want to talk about the holiday traditions and customs. What are some of those customs and traditions that are unique to this area people might not know about?
Well, the main thing that we were doing here in the 1800s and into the 1900s was a practice that had come from Germany into immigrants that went into Pennsylvania and then moved down through Maryland, perhaps some of West Virginia, but into Virginia, into the Shenandoah Valley. The main practice was something called Belschnickling, and it was done around Christmas time, maybe from the Christmas, the week of Christmas, to the week of New Year's, 2 or 3 weeks. People would dress in disguise, put on clothes that was way bigger than they are, and then maybe stuffing them with other clothes or with pillows to emphasize their body shape completely different from what it really was, put on masks. Originally, a lot of the masks they made were perhaps from a pillowcase or a bag of some type, just even a paper bag in some cases, cut out mouth and eye holes, and then maybe decorate it so it looks a little scary or something. Maybe wear a hat. But the point was here, well, in Pennsylvania, the point was the Belschnickler was a gift giver, going to a house with some goodies, maybe some cakes and cookies or candy for the children, but then also with a switch, usually a birch switch, for the students that had misbehaved.
Oh, my goodness.
So when they would go into a house in let's say, the Lancaster area of Pennsylvania, they would ask, have you been good? Have you been bad? And so forth. And if they were bad, they got some swipes from the switch.
Oh, my goodness.
And weren't allowed to get any of the candy or the goodies.
Okay.
When it moved here, it actually changed a little bit to be just a visiting of homes, neighbors, friends, family, after dark, in the evening, going to a house and announcing your presence there at the house, and then being invited in. And the point was, could they guess who you were? You tried to disguise your voice, the way you looked, your size, and everything. And if they couldn't guess you, I guess you felt kind of good that you had the ultimate disguise. But if they did guess you who you were, you had to take off your mask. And then everybody that was participating, these Belschnicklers, were a whole group of them. Pennsylvania tended to be a single person doing it. Here, groups of the people would gather together to do this. And so you might have had 6 to 12 people come into your house dressed this way, and they expected a treat of some kind. Generally, it was cider and cookies. And sometimes even the cider was hard cider, which made for more interesting revelers as they moved on to the next house and the next house and the next house.
Right. Yeah, you mentioned the Pennsylvania roots, and I believe before we were recording, you were talking and educating me a little bit more about that, where the immigrants to this valley come from is mainly of German origin and up from Pennsylvania. Did I hear that correctly?
That's right. Most of the people that settled in Rockingham County, where we are, and Shenandoah County to our north, the Jason County, came from the areas of Germany that were along the Rhine River in Germany, Switzerland, and parts of Alsace in France that spoke German, those three areas. They're the ones that came into Pennsylvania and then eventually came from Pennsylvania through Maryland on into Virginia. And so a majority of them settled here in Rockingham, the center part of the valley, and they maintained a lot of these traditions that had been born in the old lands where their ancestors had come from.
And brought them here to our area. Mm. I see. Can you share a story or legend that stands out to you beyond the bell snickling that's tied to our winter season here in our valley's past that stands out to you?
Well, another thing, another variation on bell snickling was called Shanghaiing.
Okay.
Not as many people did that, and mostly in the eastern part of our present county, but they would ride on horses or donkeys and visit homes, but they wouldn't want to be let in the house. They would just ride by in the daytime.
Hmm.
The bell snicklers in the other part of the county, they were doing that after dark, and so they were walking generally, carrying lanterns since they were in the dark and needed it to see. So that was a little bit different. And then some people locally called the bell snickling Kris Kringling.
Really?
And it was basically the same thing. All of those things have origins in Germany. The Kris Kringling, the bell snickling. And the name in German was Der Bellschnickel. And what that meant was in German, Nicholas in furs. So it was Saint Nicholas, you know, another name for Santa Claus,
mm-hmm.
that was dressed in furs. And that's where that name came from. But in Pennsylvania, they were looking to discriminate between the good and the bad behavior of the children.
Mm-hmm.
Here, we didn't do that as much. It was everybody got treats and just try to be a little bit more, I guess, careful and
mm-hmm.
and not discriminating against behavior.
I like that change.
Yeah.
I like that change a lot. What role do you think or have you seen or read about that faith and church gatherings play in the shaping of the holiday celebrations here?
The thing that I think most people here would probably say is the Christmas Eve program in their church, where they would have a pageant of some type or play or something like that, or maybe just a musical presentation. But they often had the children learn lines to say, things to repeat to the audience. And a lot of times the audience would laugh and laugh and laugh because of somebody, you know, being a little bit off subject or...
Those are the best.
Has lost concentration of what was going on.
Right. And those still carry on today.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Then some of the traditions fade over time while others evolve. What are some of the older traditions? I think you mentioned Bellschnickling?
Bellschnickling.
Bellschnickling did evolve from Pennsylvania to over here. Are there some other ones that have evolved over time?
Well, let's see. Let's think about some of the other things that there were a lot of practices that were also from England
mm-hmm.
that crept into the valley, and one of those would be wassailing, the wassail bowl.
I don't know.
Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not. What is that?
Well, it was a bowl that had a sort of a punch type of drink in, and people would mull. They called it mulled. M-U-L-L-E-D punch, and then people would maybe sing around the wassail bowl or sit in a large table and have a meal, have the wassail bowl in the center. And it's still practiced some. A lot of times it might be in a college where they do wassail, and they called it Here We Go, a Wassailing is a well-known song related to that. Some of the other things that came from England would be carols.
Mm.
Of course, there were also some from Europe too, but the first carols were actually Roman inspired. And then in the Victorian era, they became very popular. And of course, we're still singing some of those carols today in churches or in programs elsewhere.
Yeah. The St. Nicholas or Christmas as we know it, the Santa Claus as we know it, has that evolved over time here in the valley too, historically?
The original St. Nicholas was living in Asia Minor in the 4th century, so he's a long time ago. But in Germany, that's where the gift giving came from, because Nicholas himself was supposedly a secret gift giver that gave gifts to generally to children. And then modern day Santa Claus has kind of come from him. And I was thinking recently about the fact that Santa, if you think about some of the songs that were written about Santa, he's making a list and checking it twice.
Yeah.
Going to find out who's naughty and nice.
Yes.
There's that same thing where they're trying to figure out who were the good kids and who were the bad kids. So what happened if you were a bad kid in more modern times? Well, you generally got something in your stocking instead of something nice like an orange, which was kind of hard to get here in the wintertime years ago. You might get a lump of coal. You might get some rocks, a bag of salt, onions and garlic, something like that, if you had been bad.
Mm, I see. Not a lot of toys or electronics, of course.
Definitely not.
So if you were a good kid, you got food items, and if not, you would get the coal and rocks and things of that nature.
Generally, correct.
Okay. I would hope that didn't happen often.
Well, in colonial Virginia, a lot of times children did get a little toy, a trinket or something.
Yeah.
The girls might have gotten a doll or something like that. But the parents gave these gifts, but they didn't expect anything in return in colonial times.
Okay. What about food? What kind of traditions were there for their Christmas feasts or gatherings with friends and family?
Well, the meats tended to be ham at Christmas. It had been turkey at Thanksgiving, but ham at Christmas. And then other things that went with it. A lot of them were carryovers from the Thanksgiving meal, where they were doing the turkey dressing, gravy, mashed potatoes, cranberry sauce, so forth. So a lot of that also was being served in the Christmas meals too.
Would you say there were pies or cakes that they made then that they don't make now?
One of the cakes was called a Christmas cake.
Okay.
And the different thing about it was just loaded with fruit. So we'd think of a modern day fruitcake in some respects, but a lot of fruitcakes don't have very good reputations because people almost don't see them as a good gift, right?
Right. Yeah. I actually have a joke about that. I do it during Christmas every year. I did a spinoff with that just recently. So agree.
Well, there's some things that also were involved with Christmas. For instance, candy canes. Mm. And a lot of these things have meaning, if you think about it, often that refers to some religious thing. For the candy cane, the red was supposed to be sort of the sacrifice, the blood sacrifice of Christ. And the white was supposed to be purity, the two colors there. The treats that people gave at Christmas time, even churches today, some carryovers from decades and decades ago, they're still giving out oranges every Christmas, which used to be something you only got occasionally. Now you can get them anytime. But they also gave out peanut brittle, chocolate drops, hard candies, different things like that. A lot of kids got those at their church, given out as treats there, perhaps by the family too at home, but definitely at church.
Did they do gift giving? I know we've talked about what they could find in their stockings. Was there gift giving exchanges like we have today early on? And if so, what kind of gifts would they have received beyond the food items or lack thereof in the stockings?
Well, most people just got something very meager in their stockings. And it might have just been an orange, or it might just have been something. A lot of families were hand to mouth almost on on their food and so forth, they didn't have a lot of money to be spending on gifts generally. And so the gifts tended to be very, very simple.
Colonial days. What kind of toys would they, if they had toys back then, what kind of toys would it have been?
It might have been a wire hoop or a metal hoop that and a stick that the boys would use to kind of roll along on the ground, make a roll. The girls would have probably been given a simple doll, perhaps mainly one that was just made of all fabric and not anything like porcelain or something. It would have been more expensive. And then another toy that was often given was there was a handle that had a cup at the top, a wooden handle, cup at the top, and then a ball on a string. And so the idea was to get the ball to go into the cup by swinging it just properly. Okay. That was the famous toy.
What about the Christmas trees and Christmas wreaths? Does that go back to these times too?
You know, the Christmas trees actually came from Germany. That tradition came into the United States. But the earliest Christmas trees were probably in Roman times. And then at one point, people were hanging their Christmas trees upside down.
Why were they hanging them upside down?
I don't really know. Well, I do know what it was supposed to. It was supposed to symbolize the Trinity. Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, three. So, you know, they were still three-sided, sort of, when you had them right side up, but they would hang them from the ceiling. And I've seen pictures of recent trees that people had in their houses that were upside down. Some were from the ceiling, and some had the top of the tree stuck in a tree stand on the floor.
How did they imagine that represented the Trinity? I'm having a disconnection.
Okay, so it would have been something like a pine tree that had, you know, sides that were two, and then the bottom would have been the third side.
Okay, I got it. Okay.
So in England, trees became popular when Queen Victoria and her German Prince Albert had a tree that they did on a table in their home, in the castle maybe, with gifts on top of the table. And an etching was done of that in a paper or something. And it just became a sensation in England that everybody wanted a Christmas tree that they could put on their table with gifts around it.
Now, that's great. Did they believe in good luck and bad luck?
Some things that were supposed to be good luck. If you decorated with holly, but the holly had to have the berries on it. If it didn't have the berries, it wouldn't be good luck. And you had to get all of your Christmas decorations down by the 12th night. The 12th night starts on Christmas. It's the 12th day after that. You're supposed to have all your decorations put away by that point. If you didn't, it would be bad luck. If it was after January the 6th, which was the 12th day or night after that. Another thing that was supposed to bring you good luck is you're supposed to sweep the bad things out of your house on Christmas Day. So it would be like take a broom, go to your front door, and kind of sweep dust out the door. And another thing was good luck was kissing under the mistletoe.
Okay.
It was kind of interesting that some people believed that the mistletoe had fallen from heaven, and that's because it tends to be in the tops of the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of, I guess it was a wonderment that it was there in the top of the tree. Where did it come from? Did it fall from heaven? And some people believed that.
That's really interesting. I think the way that they decorated would have been very fascinating. Any greenery outside, they certainly didn't have lights and that sort of thing that we do today. But did they do any type of outdoor decoration or is primarily inside?
A lot of people put some greenery around their windows
outside,
so you would have seen it that way. They were mainly using four types of greenery: pine, perhaps white pine, holly, with the berries on it. And also, holly sort of reminded people of the crown of thorns that Christ wore because of the little stickers on the edges of the leaves. Ivy was used as an evergreen, and also the mistletoe that I mentioned.
Go ahead.
Well, they were mainly the four types of greenery that people around here were using.
When did they start decorating for the holiday season? We see our stores tend to start decorating before Halloween, but when did we start doing that here earlier?
I think, in some cases, people didn't put up their tree until Christmas Eve after the kids had gone to bed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so they wouldn't have seen the tree until they wake up the next morning.
Now,
that seems a little unusual these days, but at one time that was fairly popular. And so I don't think the decoration went very much earlier than maybe the week prior to Christmas.
Wow. So then the kids would have had a whole big surprise.
Yes.
In the morning. That was a big deal.
Very much so.
Okay. What was the average size family in the 1700s, 1800s? Do you know?
Well, infant mortalities were so great. A lot of children just didn't survive. But I'm guessing maybe 4 to 6 would have been maybe average.
Okay.
In that time.
4 to 6 kids.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Big time farm families mostly, right?
Right. Uh-huh.
Okay.
And one thing about the Germans that moved here into the valley, immigrants from Pennsylvania or whatever, a lot of times they had so many children that they could get by without having slaves to help on their farms. So that's one reason. Of course, they were also anti-slavery from anti-slavery denominations religiously, but they just had kids coming along helping with the farm chores because of having maybe 10, even 12 children.
Mm. That is fascinating. We do have quite the history here with regards to that, and we have a tie to Abraham Lincoln here as well, don't we?
Right. Abraham Lincoln's our president. His father, Thomas, was actually born here in Rockingham County on Linville Creek, which is a creek that runs north of Harrisonburg. And Thomas then moved to Kentucky. And Abraham, of course, was born there rather than here in Virginia. But Thomas Lincoln's family had lived here in Virginia since almost the mid-1700s on this Linville Creek. There's still a Lincoln homestead here on Linville Creek. Linville Creek is a highway that has a highway beside it called Route 42 through Rockingham County. And there's a Lincoln homestead there with a cemetery, a Lincoln cemetery, that's a little bit north of the homestead. And every year in February on Lincoln's birthday, a local attorney who's a former college president gives a talk about some topic dealing with Abraham Lincoln and the Lincoln family. And generally it's different every year. And people go to the cemetery. There's an iron fence around the cemetery. You have to kind of walk up in a field to get to it. But it's usually pretty widely attended, even on the coldest of February days.
And that former attorney, college president, was, I think, Mr. Stone?
Philip Stone.
Uh-huh. Philip Stone. It was Bridgewater College?
Bridgewater College.
Okay.
And also when Sweetbriar College, which is in sort of central Virginia, south of Charlottesville, when they were having some problems, he went there and helped. They were having some financial issues, and he went there and kind of got them steered back on a good financial path.
Oh, sounds like a good guy. So he'll do this outside every year. How would someone who's watching or listening to this episode be able to find out more information about that program.
He is involved with a Lincoln Society of Virginia.
Okay.
And I'm sure if you would Google that, you'd find out probably maybe through their Facebook page information about when that is happening, mm-hmm. where, and find some information about maybe even finding the place. It's not that hard to find if you're here in the county. Most people would know where the Lincoln Homestead and Cemetery were.
That reminds me, I want to also share, before I forget, to get a copy of the Lucy Sims book that you wrote. They can get it in a couple of places, I believe. One's here at the Rocktown History Museum.
Yes.
And then where's the other place?
At Oasis Arts in Harrisonburg on Main Street. That used to be Hostetter's drugstore.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's before my time here.
Yes. And, okay. And the amazing thing was they had an electric eye. The doorway to enter that building is sort of on the corner of the building.
Right.
And they had this electric eye that when you would walk past it, it would open the door automatically.
And,
you
really?
Know, it's before other places around here had doors that opened.
Okay. And that's not functional right now.
No.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, that's a good center for local artists. And
yes, it is.
They do have the Lucy Sims book there for sale.
With it's autographed too, right?
Right.
So you heard it here, laughers, right here. You get an autographed copy from Dale McAllister on his book with Lucy Sims. Have you written other books too? I think you've contributed.
I've contributed with mainly JMU professors with a book about Harrisonburg. Way back in 1975, I wrote a history of my church. Okay. And I did that after my grandmother had died as sort of a dedication to her because she was a very faithful member in that church.
Okay, and you've written many articles too. Like we have here your latest release of the Shenandoah Valley Folklife Society, which you're a leader of. How long have you been leading this society?
Well, at least 3 decades.
That's a few years, laughers. Yeah. And in here, you talked about the besheckling as well as some New Year's traditions. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, on this current newsletter, which is our winter 2024 edition, I wanted to have something that was seasonal in it because I didn't have much about Christmas. So I thought about a New Year's tradition that was called shooting in the New Year. And it had to do with primarily farmers would take a long rifle outside and shoot it into the air on New Year's Eve when I think the clock struck midnight. That's when it was done. Of course, they probably didn't think too much about the fact that when something goes up, it has to come down. So the bullets landed someplace nearby, and whether it was dangerous or not, maybe it had to do with how close you were to where the gun had been fired.
It looks like from what you wrote here, too, they made wishes to rid themselves of bad habits that needed to be changed, and much like we do now, look forward to fresh starts in the new year.
Correct.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And they were doing that as they were shooting the guns, or is this...
Well, some people were doing it separately, and some people were also doing it in connection with the shooting the guns off.
Okay, so it's their form of fireworks.
Right.
Okay, I like that.
And well, in fact,
yeah,
in more modern times, it would have been the fireworks because of prohibitions against firing guns into the air.
Okay.
It's called celebratory gunfire.
Okay.
And of course, you know, that's in the Muslim world, I think that's a standard practice.
Okay.
Celebratory gun firing.
Oh. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's, I get very much educated today, laughers, on a lot of our own heritage around here. I didn't even know. And you've got in the back here, just to give people a sampling, if they never like to get your newsletter, the last article is Reminiscing of an Old Man, Chapter 4, mm-hmm. Reminiscences. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, this is a man who lived in Page County, Virginia, which is an adjacent county to Rockingham, where we are. Mm-hmm. And he was born in the late 1790s. And so he grew up in the 18-teens, lived through the 1870s. And he was writing about things he remembered throughout his life that a lot of people would have trouble coming up with some of the things he remembered that happened, that he had a good memory, remembered names, events. And so all of his memories were put into letters that he sent to a Luray, Virginia newspaper. And what I've been doing is including what he had in a letter in the last couple issues of this newsletter.
That's really, really fascinating, and to be able to see what someone in that time wrote about our area. And then on the back, you have this picture. And if you're watching this on YouTube, I'm going to show it to you, this picture. It is a picture of Dr. Elmer Smith, John Stewart, and Wilson Brenneman. And then I would like for you to talk a little bit about what's in this picture.
Well, Dr. Smith, Elmer Smith, and John Stewart were founders of the Shenandoah Valley Folklife Society now, in the late 1960s. Mm-hmm. And they were interested in the things that were traditions still being carried by German descendants, mm-hmm, who were living here in the valley and in nearby West Virginia. They did a lot of interviewing of people about practices in their life, things that they did that perhaps had roots in Germany, in Europe. Mm-hmm. And in this picture, they are examining a blanket chest, a large wooden blanket chest, and inside the top lid are two papers that have been glued into it, mm-hmm, and they are fraktur, F-R-A-K-T-U-R, which are marriage and birth certificates that are illuminated and very fancily decorated with symbols. Often they would have birds in them and maybe trees and different types of things like that. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these were done by families to sort of document a birth, a marriage, and they're very valuable. The ones here that are glued into top of this blanket chest are very difficult to get off without damaging them. So I know a lot of people have ruined valuable fraktur because they tried to take them off without doing it professionally. Mm. But maybe just leave them in place rather than ruin them by trying to get them out.
Yeah, I think you were telling me that Joseph, I think we were just talking about him. Was he the one that had trouble misspelling and he did these fraktures, or was that somebody else you were telling me about?
The most famous fraktur artist locally was a Peter Bernhardt, lived in this county, and he was the schoolmaster. He delivered papers from Winchester along the Valley Pike down to Stanton, I think, was his range. And he did a lot of fraktur decorating, was a schoolmaster, but he was a poor speller. And people that, a lot of times these would be in German, mm-hmm, the old German script. And so you'd have to have somebody that could read German script to tell you what they say. But Dr. Stewart, that's in this picture, was from Europe, and so he could read this script, and he's the one that realized that he was a pretty poor speller.
A schoolmaster, poor speller. That's a little ironic. What would you say is your favorite piece of holiday history or personal tradition that connects you to your valley's past?
Well, certainly decorating Christmas trees. In these days, so many people have artificial trees, mm-hmm, and some of the more expensive ones look almost more like a real tree than one that you'd go out and cut yourself. some of the early trees that were artificial, it's kind of interesting, their feather trees. These mainly were done, I think, in Germany to start with. They would get goose feathers, dye them green, and then and then wrap them around wire. The wire served as a limb, and so they're called feather trees because they're actually parts of goose feathers. There are other kinds that came along later, same type, but they didn't use goose feathers. They just used something else that was a little bit more modern in design.
And so you're a natural tree, Christmas tree person, or artificial?
Actually, natural, I think. There are a good many Christmas tree farms here locally.
And there are.
Our weather the last few years have not been so good with rain, and they've been having trouble. And some of them have to have trees like fir hauled in from other states to supply the market here because their own trees had just not had not done well because of the dry conditions.
Okay. All right. So that's one of your favorite pieces of the history and personal tradition is the tree tradition. Is that what I'm gathering?
Well,
summing up.
it's kind of strange, but I have a collection of Christmas tree pins that, you know, brooches that people would wear.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so that's still that tree theme.
Okay, where do you find the brooches?
All over antique shops, flea markets, so forth.
What's the most unusual brooch that you feel you've found so far?
Well, one is just all pewter.
Oh, really?
And so it looks very bland because pewter is sort of a dull gray color, and that's what the whole tree looks like.
Okay.
The other pins often have sort of either, they might be silver, they might be gold, but they probably have some colors on to represent the balls on the trees or the candles that might have been on the trees or something like that.
Okay. Where's the farthest you've been from here where you found one?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. Probably Pennsylvania, perhaps.
Okay. All right. How many do you have?
I don't even know.
You have a lot of them.
I've just been a collector all my life of various things. So.
Okay. What other things do you collect?
Oh, like political buttons and
okay.
Yeah, just lots of things.
Okay, from back in history.
Maybe buttons about World War II from that time period that are related to the war effort. I have some of those.
Okay, when did you start collecting items?
1970s, I guess.
Okay, that's interesting. What's your favorite collection?
Probably some Victorian glassware that doesn't bring as much these days as it did, say, 10, 20 years ago.
Okay. And you find those in antique shops too?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's pretty amazing. I like that. I did not have never met anybody that's collected Christmas tree brooches before. I love that so much. If someone wanted to explore local holiday history here themselves, what resources or landmarks would you recommend they start with?
Well, I think they could visit our museum here at Rocktown History. And I don't know that we have specifically an exhibit right now, but we would have books that go into some of the Christmas traditions here in the library that they could read up about. And some of them would have been these traditions that came down through the Germans and Swiss ancestors that brought them over to North America.
Okay, that's good. That can make a great Christmas gift, Laffers. To get a book on that, I think that would be fascinating. As we wrap up here, how best can the Laffers follow you on social media? I don't think you're much on social media, but how can they follow you or connect with you in the best way?
I think just have them contact Rocktown History.
Okay.
A lot of times what I'm doing is working, since I'm called the resident historian, I'm working on history questions that people want answers to. That it may take a little bit of research to come up with an answer, and maybe other people have tried to answer but have not succeeded. So I'm often doing work in that regard.
Okay, great. And Laffers, their website is rocktownhistory.org. We'll be sure to put that information for you in the show notes so that you can grab it. Don't worry if you're working out or driving, because you can find it right there. And I want to thank you, Dale, for coming on and joining us today to talk about all things history, about holiday traditions and folk life in the Shenandoah Valley. Thank you for this special edition and joining me today to share that with our Laffers. I appreciate you so much.
You're certainly welcome.
Yes. And also, Laffers, thank you for spending time with us today. And we so much appreciate you, because we cannot do what we do without you or share all this amazing content to help people get more out of their Shenandoah Valley experience. So if you enjoyed your time today, give this podcast a like, share, and tell a friend, and follow us so that you can see what's coming up next. Because we have a lot more content coming in 2025. And lastly, and most importantly, thanks for tuning in, Laffers. Out of all the podcasts out there, you picked us, and we think that's pretty darn special, just like you. Until next time, keep smiling. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Virginia is for Laffers podcast, brought to you by the Funny Womack and Friends. We'll be dropping a new podcast every Wednesday, so check back for another uplifting episode. Come to a FWAF show or let us bring one to you. To find out more, head to thefunnywomacks.com. Be sure to share this podcast with a friend, and until next time, cheers.